Hi, this is Damien O'Doherty. Welcome to the Lobby Pod. We are blessed to have a premier advocate and lawyer in the business, D. Robert Enten from the esteemed law firm Gordon Feinblatt, LLC, home to the greatest law library I know of in Baltimore, Maryland. And but now, Bob, another institution in Maryland, legal proceedings in the law, in government affairs. Listen to this. Robert Enten, D. Robert Enten, has been named by Best Lawyers of America as the 2022 Government Relations Lawyer of the Year in Baltimore. This is the second time. He was previously recognized in 2015. Bob Enten, welcome to the Lobby Pod. So psyched to have you with us.
Good morning, Damien. It's great to be here. Nice to hear from you.
You know, I was just waiting for like a moment where I couldn't screw up the introduction because you've been such a, I think you've been such a meaningful influence in my life and how I approach public affairs, or how I would like to say how I wish I approached public affairs and how I wish I approached government affairs. But, I'm not the only one. It seems to me, if you look at the list of the top people in our world of public affairs in Maryland, you know, they will have all been by your side at some time. You've trained the best and the brightest. What do you say about all that?
Well, I remember you. I think the first time I ever met you was when you worked for Senator McFadden. How many years ago was that, Damien?
That was 1997.
So that's
24 years ago.
Yeah. And he had a bill, and I forget which client it was. It might have been the Bankers Association. And you and I worked out a set of amendments on that bill. And then we got along great. We stayed in touch all the years since then. And I enjoy your company, and I like to play golf with you now and then, and see you. And if I ever get out to Aspen again, I'm going to certainly look you up.
I will travel with golf bag at any time.
I know.
You play so. A place I've learned is one of the most beautiful golf courses in all of the Mid-Atlantic, which is the Hayfields.
Yeah, it's very pretty out there. You know, it's right at the base of Oregon Ridge. And, you know, you almost can look at that and think you were like, you know, out in the West someplace, because you're at the base of the ridge there. It's a very, very pretty spot. I enjoy it.
My audience would be, they would like to hear about, you know, we in the industry know, Bob, I think I would speak for the whole industry. You know, people think you are a tireless advocate for your clients. They often use the word pit bull, which I always take to me. I don't think that's disparaging your looks in any way, but it does. I think pit bulls do have a thing where they do not let go, or they do not let go of the issue, or they do not let go of your, you know. So I'd love to hear how you. It's a tough business, and you have been at the center of it for decades now, and you've always presented the most, I think, professional. What would Senator Blount say? Comportment. Comport yourself, the way you comport yourself, your comportment is, you know, and your composure is very compelling. And but you're also relentless. And I just, how do you get a work style like that? Because to me, that looks like you're not running a marathon. It looks like to me every day you were waking up and running a sprint. And I don't know how you do it every day. I think all of us in the community would love to learn like how Bob Enten became known as the most relentless and tireless advocate for the most, you know, sophisticated institutional clients, you know, banking, insurance, people that have been in this business for centuries. They go to you over the last 20 and 30 years. Just love to know how you developed that work ethic.
Well, I can tell you that it's funny that you asked that question. I've been asked, I mean, I think that's some people do characterize me in that fashion. And, you know, I grew up watching Perry Mason on television, Raymond Burr. And Perry Mason never lost a case, ever. He won every case. And he was on TV for a long, long time when I was growing up. And when I became a lawyer, I did a ton of litigation, both civil and a lot of criminal. And I always thought that if I was smart enough and I worked hard enough, I should be able to figure out a way to win every case, just like Perry Mason did. And of course, that's not reality. And you learn after a while that you're not, you know, that, you know, depending on the facts, depending on the law, that's not going to happen. But I think that I do work very, you know, try to work very, very hard, because I would never, ever want to think that if I worked harder, I could have gotten a better result for my client. That's the one thing that I couldn't live with. And so for me, it's, you know, it's a 90-day sprint. Not that I don't work the rest of the year round, but nothing's like that 90 days. And it's just my, you know, my attitude. I feel like, particularly in the world of politics and in the world of lobbying, there's a lot of things that are totally outside the advocates, whether whatever side you're on, that outside of your control. There's politics, but I would never want to think but I've come to be able to live with not winning 100% of the time, and I have a pretty good batting average.
Did
I work as hard as anybody could work? And did I not do anything stupid? And, you know, once again, I can't stand losing, I mean, those are the kind of thresholds for me. You know, I guess sometimes we think we all could have done things a little differently, but, you know, lobbying to me is, it's like a chess game. You have to be able to see what the moves are down the road. You have to be able to look and say, okay, if this happens, then that'll happen. And if that happens, then this will happen. And, you know, where am I going to end up? If I do this, what will the reaction be? If the other side does that, what will the reaction be? And you try to, you know, look down the road and see how it's going to play out and adjust your strategy, you know, as you go along, you know, plan an original strategy. Who are you going to get to sponsor the bills? Who are you going to meet with? What's your position going to be? But the one thing that we can all control is how hard we work. And there are a number of very good lobbyists in Annapolis, and those are the ones you see there first thing in the morning and the last thing in the evening. So that's just always, and that's always been my kind of work ethic throughout my career as an attorney and in Annapolis. So
yeah, and earliest in the morning and the latest of the evening, I've never seen you as a social, carousing, you know, late night Annapolis type of person. I've always seen you as
you know, morning, noon, and night in a banker suit during those 90 days and a pair of nice shoes. And I, you know, I'm guessing even people that are really progressive liberal Democrats, you know, you may want to pull them over and talk to them, and their first inclination might be, if they don't know you, they might be like, what intersection do my issues have with Bob? And then I think they would see you working and they would be like, I should talk to this guy now because I'm going to be talking to him eventually. So I'd love to hear how a business, you know,
and you would hate the term business leader. You're like, I'm just a lawyer, whatever. But when you're the face of the banking industry, the insurance industry, in before state legislators and regulators, I mean, you are a business leader. I'm sorry to tell you, Bob. How do you act as a business leader? How do you show yourself as a business leader in a state where, you know, so much of the policy conversation comes at a more, you know, progressive, sort of reform oriented point of view from this new generation of legislators? Or maybe I have it all wrong, but I'd love to hear. You've been so successful with that. I'd love to hear how you get it done.
Well, you know, I think that whether, you know, a legislator is a progressive, is a conservative, is in the middle, I do believe they all want to do the right thing. And furnishing them with information and, you know, credible information, even though it may kind of be opposite of their view, I find that almost without exception, they're all willing to sit down with you and listen. You know, it's a and weigh what you say. We've had a couple legislators in particular. I'm thinking of one that moved to Congress and to the U.S. Senate. And I would always come in and talk to him when he was in the Maryland Senate. I'd make my case. He'd listen. He'd ask all the right questions. And then he would say, Bob, I'm sorry, but I can't be with you on this one. And that was fine. You know, you can't expect that you're going to, you know, that everybody's going to go with your position. But the key is to at least get them to listen to you and to maintain a cordial relationship. I mean, what's helped me over the years is because I have been there so long is that, and because I do go to the witness table on everything, basically, and that's kind of old school, making sure you go to the witness table. And I'm not saying that there's not a lot of stuff beyond going to the witness table. Now we're limited sometimes to 1 or 2 minutes, but you do make an impression on people when you do that. And it makes an impression when, you know, a new legislator, you know, sees the way the veterans treat you.
Wow, yeah, that's a great
point. In
bill
hearings and discussions and subcommittees and in work groups. And it helps, you know, it helps. So I try to maintain a cordial relationship with everybody, regardless of what side of the fence they're on issues. You know, the session is so compacted, and we have, you know, well over 2,000 bills that get introduced, almost 3,000 bills get introduced now every session, and they got 90 days to deal with them. And their time is very precious. Now, not like the old days, every committee has subcommittees. So you have a bill hearing, and the bill gets assigned to the subcommittee. Then the subcommittee basically has a whole nother hearing, many of them. People are busy, and you have to have it really helps if you have a nice relationship with them, if they like you and they respect you, to get them to take the time to talk to you and hear your point of view. And, you know, the main thing I always want to know as much as anything is from a legislator is, where are you on this? And if they're not with me, well, then fine. I know I got to go talk to somebody else and try to pick up, you know, the votes that I need. And of course, leadership plays a big role too. In particular, you have to have good relationships with committee chairs, vice chairs, subcommittee chairs, the speaker, staff, the president, staff, you know, the president, the speaker, all that.
Is there a difference between the quick no and the hard no?
I think for the most part, you know, some legislators just won't tell you at all. They say, well, thanks for talking to me. I'll get back to you, or I'll take that into consideration. But you get a general sense of where people are going to be based on their reaction to things, based on the bills that they introduce. So, you know, based on the bills that delegate X introduces, that you got a pretty good sense of where that delegate or where that senator, say, is going to be on most of the issues. But I do think that part of the system is that, you know, it's an advocacy system. And, you know, people like me and my colleagues and other firms, you know, you advocate on behalf of your clients. I always make it, it's somewhat akin to, in the legal world, what we call the adversary system, which is our Maryland legal system, where you have an attorney for the plaintiff, an attorney for the defendant, or attorney for the state and for the criminal defendant. And you make the best case you can, and they make the best case they can. And theoretically, all the important facts then on both sides get in front of a judge or a jury, and that helps them to make the best decision. And I think that the legislative system that we have in Maryland is fairly akin to that. I'm going to make the best case I can for my client. Let's say if I'm trying to pass a bill. And then if there are groups that are opposed to the bill, they're going to make the best case they can for their client. You know, whether they have, you know, an in-house lobbyist or an outside lobbyist. And that way the legislature gets to hear both sides of the argument and then makes hopefully the best and the right decision. And I think most of the time the legislators in Maryland, regardless of party, regardless of their philosophy, they really try very, very hard to do the right thing and to, you know, weigh everything and make a balanced, as you know, a fairly balanced decision. And even the most progressive and the most conservative legislators, I think, are usually open to amendments that make sense and that don't harm the bill and that make sense, maybe improve the bill. So I think the system works pretty good.
You know what, this thing, this idea about you get 2 minutes up there and utilizing that 2 minutes as an advocate, you know, I come from a sort of a generation of thinking that was sort of like, the hearings are showtime. And, you know, the business community, if they pop their head up there, they might get it whacked off by a legislator or two. And so there was kind of a hang back mentality, which differed from when I first got in the legislature, when I saw you. And I think also I had a chance to see Jim Doyle, which seemed to be maybe somebody that you held in some esteem as you were coming up. But he would always say, you know, my name is Jim Doyle and I'm a lawyer from Baltimore. And then He did what my granddad was accused of doing in the most loving way by judges, who said, I loved your granddad when he came before my court because he would not cede the courtroom to the judge. And I think there's something about your approach where you sort of saying, hey, I'm going to take back our time, or at least my time, and give you my perspective, this point of view. I think there, obviously there's something to it. You've been so successful with it, but how would you talk about this to, you know, maybe some 26-year-old lobbyist for a teachers union or what have you, that's like, should I go up there and testify? Or a business executive out of Hunt Valley that's listening to this podcast and saying, you know, to the business community, I wonder if we get cheated sometimes because we have advocates that are always trying to make things a little easier and more efficient on their end versus what Bob Enton's doing, which is just putting his face and name right out there on the issue at every bill hearing. So I'd love to get your reaction to that. And if I got any of that wrong, I'll take a scolding.
No, I really do. See, for me, and, you know, I'm just, you know, I'm old school, I guess. And, you know, I believe in going to the witness table. I think it's important. I think it's important to create an impression, even if you only have a couple of minutes. And, you know, the way the system works, you know, they put, and they never used, this all kind of started maybe in the last 5 years where they would, quote, put you on the clock, unquote. But then the members get to ask questions, and there's no time limit on the questions, and there's no time limit on the answers to the questions. So, you know, you can answer the question and, you know, kind of make your points through the answers that you give to the questions. Now, sometimes you don't get too much in the way of questions, but if you do, you know, you can continue to advocate. But then once again, it's so important to circle back with the legislators, and particularly, you know, if you can, if you have the relationships to circle back with the chair, with the vice chair, with the chairman of the subcommittee. You know, the House is, has a much more formalized subcommittee system than the Senate does. And to, you know, to circle back with staff, you have to have all those relationships. And I really think that those relationships come with people respecting and appreciating the information that you that you give them. That's where I think it's, you know, staff plays a key role in all of this. You know, who's drafting the amendments? When you sit through a voting session, and now you can watch all the voting sessions live on the internet. They turn to staff with questions. You know, what's this language mean? What's that language mean? So to the extent that you can meet and talk with staff, that's also super important. And that goes up and down the line from the, you know, president and speaker's office down to the different members of the committees. And, you know, if people don't like you and find you offensive, they're not going to want to meet with you. You can't, they're not obligated to meet with you. They're not obligated to pay attention to what you say. So, you know, I think you kind of have to approach people in the right way, in a friendly way, and give them good information. And then hopefully they're willing to hear you out.
Wait, do you see me?
I mean, that's kind of how I look at it.
Wait, do you see me pitching my clients? I'm going to be like this year. I'm going to be like, this year, we're going to bring back the testimony. We're going to do the full Enten, which means we need to, I think I can price this thing perfectly. The full Enten. Something with a 99 on the end of it. In honor of your bankers. Listen, you've got a hell of a team over there. Todd Chasen, Michael Powell, Jason Weintraub, Margaret Withrop. You know, talk to me about what it's like to, you have a unique profile as somebody who's very much their own professional, so to speak. But at the same time, you have the resources of one of, you know, Maryland's most notable firms. And I always call it like a silk stocking firm, or, you know, you guys have all the finest clients, and now you're down there in Harbor Point, I think. Beautiful space. Whoever got all that stuff approved, let's God bless them at KO Public Affairs. But talk to me about your team there, Gordon Feinblatt, and what that platform allows you to do as a professional. Because again, I think a lot of people, you know, like me, who went out there to interview, I was like, man, there's no way I would fit into this firm of like top flight lawyers that are just like on top of everything. I mean, it's very intimidating for people in the government affairs space that feels like their world is a little looser, a little less buttoned up, you know? And I just wonder how you manage and really optimize that platform. I don't know anybody that does it quite like you.
Well, thank you. And I, you know, look, I've been at Gordon Feinblatt for 27 years now. And before that, I was with the Weinberg and Green, which is one of the largest firms in Baltimore at the time. I was with them for 10 years. And you know, one of the nice things is that you have the backup resources. So, you know, you mentioned Mike Powell. I mean, Mike Powell is probably, you know, one of the top two or three esteemed environmental lawyers in the state of Maryland. Back, you know, he was the lead assistant attorney general for years for the Maryland Department of the Environment. And it's
I'll put it a simpler way. When I was coming up as a legislative counsel in the state Senate, and I would like creep down to the finance committee from EEA, Michael Powell would be sitting like at the table, talk about testimony and talk about no time limit. The man would like had full command. Like it was almost like, you know, he was, you know, they had those working groups, and it was almost like he was like the chairman of a working group. And he was so knowledgeable that, you know, he has this idea. He presents this concept like, hey, man, if you're just going to be a resource, you'd be a resource to anybody, even your opponents. You're going to give them the information you believe is correct. And I just think he developed like this really amazing reputation that he's maintained throughout his career, and obviously was a managing partner there. I know you don't do any sucking up, Bob, so I'm just taking care of that for you.
Look, Pal's terrific. He was our managing partner, and I think you're right on the mark with your evaluation of him. And kind of Todd Chasen and a young lawyer named David Bugelsman have kind of stepped into the environmental role of coming to Annapolis for energy companies. And I have to say that, you know, Maggie Witherup does a great job on many different fronts, including the environmental front. Bring in Jason Weintraub on, you know, when I'm asked about, you know, what my achievements were for the past year, Jason joined us in November from the speaker's office. And he was the number two staff guy in the speaker's office. He had been counsel to the House Ways and Means Committee. He is well-liked and well-regarded by everyone in the General Assembly.
For us Baltimore people, McDonough School graduate.
Right, McDonough School graduate, absolutely. And he's just been great to work with. And you know, I'm not a youngster, but I'm so pleased. I mean, we talk 8 or 9 times a day. I mean, it's just, and he's just got a great attitude, and everybody likes him, and everybody respects him, and he knows his stuff. So
that's what I always thought you were. You know, when I started my career, I was to always tease and be like, Bob's like the vampire. He gets the smartest young people and sucks the life out of them. And then I realized, over the course of my career, it's the other way around. We are sucking the life out of you. I know Weintraub, who's had a really distinguished career as a staff person for Mike Bush. And I know Speaker Jones and her team really love his insight and acumen.
Yeah, great.
But I get a sense he's getting a lot out of you too there, Bob.
Yeah. Well, I hope so. I mean, you know, it's different.
We're the vampires, Bob. We're the vampires.
It's a lot different. I mean, being on this side of the table is a lot different, and there's things to learn. But he's been great, and he's doing a really terrific job. So it's all. I'm really, really, really pleased with how it's going. I'm looking forward to, you know, to me. One of my, you know, I've got all these kind of rules of thumb, if you will. And one of my major rules always was if they're there, I'm there. I don't, you know, if they're there on Saturday, I'm there on Saturday. If they're there at 10 o'clock at night, I'm there at 10 o'clock.
That's right.
You know, if they're there
presence.
At 7 in the morning. That's always been the way I've been. Last year, I was in Annapolis twice the whole year. That was it. Because you couldn't get away from the computer. Everything was virtual. And, you know, if I wanted to, you know, usually if I had to testify in 4 different committees, all at 1 o'clock on a Tuesday, you know, I'd bounce from committee to committee. I'd have somebody there texting me when the bill that I had to testify on came up, and I'd run across the street or run down to the second floor to get there to testify on that. Because, you know, if I got there late, the chairman would roll his eyes, but most of them would then, okay, Mr. Renton, come on up, you know. And I was in Annapolis twice. I had 4 for 6 different computer screens on my desk at home. to be able to watch all the different committees so I could see when it was my turn to testify. I could see what bill they were on. I could hear what other people were saying. And, you know, by the time you got done, it didn't make any sense to run down to Annapolis. And fortunately, you know, if anybody ever gives me their cell phone, the number goes into my contacts immediately. And I have, you know, I can reach out to people.
That's the highest level of contact outside of face to face these days, right? Is
sure. Texting and calling them. And the question is, and normally they're pretty good about calling me back. As the session goes on, it gets harder. They think I'm a pain and they're sick of hearing from me. but usually the same thing with the staff people. Oh, Bob, how are you? But by the end of the session, it's what do you want? No, you can't go back there.
Yeah, I think I said Pitbull earlier. I meant Bulldog. I think I should have said Bulldog. Well, I have to edit that in because I saw a bulldog this weekend and they didn't let go. So I could see a bulldog texting approach.
Right. So, but, you know, that's just part of the, it's a really interesting, I think, you know, business. You know, it's, and the best thing is if, you know, my number one goal is to advance my client's position. And if I can work out a compromise, that's my number one goal, is to work out a compromise, you know, if I can. And, you know, something the client can live with, something that the legislator can live with, something that the other side can live with. But, you know, and most of the time down there, you can. Sometimes you can't. And then you just got to fight. But, you know, if you can make a compromise, that's the best of all worlds.
Well, I'm looking out at the Capitol right now from National Harbor where I'm recording this. And it's like, you know, that was the ultimate compromise, National Harbor here with the went to referendum and legislative session. But then I look over and we're looking at the Capitol is not much of a place for compromise. You know, what do you think about your role as a state lobbyist versus, you know, the friends we see at conferences and our buddies that work in Washington or our colleagues that work in corporate America that have a federal day-to-day job. I'd love to hear your thoughts on the blessing you have as somebody that operates in the state circle and Baltimore and Washington business communities and somebody who will practice law in Western Maryland. Like, yeah, you've got to have a view of that role versus yours. Be interested to hear it.
Well, I mean, I really don't. I've never lobbied, particularly, you know, in Washington. A number of our members of our congressional delegation over the years have come from the Maryland General Assembly. Chris Van Hollen was in the House and then the Maryland Senate. Of course, you know, Ben Cardin was the Speaker of the House.
Right. So you have more relation, you know, more credibility and relationships with those actors than I think many people that are operating, getting big fees in Washington to deal with some of those same people. Interesting that you've just sort of let that part of the river run by and you know, weren't.
Well, but it's such a different world, Damian. I mean, it's. My impression is it's a totally different world. You know, I know there must be Washington insider lobbyists who can, you know, who can do what I do. And they can do what I do in Annapolis. They can do it in Washington with members of the House and members of the Senate, with their chiefs of staff. But I think that if you must take the number of people that want their ear and want to make a case to them and multiply by thousands compared to what happens in Annapolis. And it just seems like it's as much as people think Annapolis is inside baseball. You know, I think that my impression of Washington is it's a thousand times more inside baseball than the Maryland legislature is. And, you know, if you look at the lobbying firms in D.C., Many of them are former legislators or former staff people. They've been doing it for a long time. There's all this. It's just a, I just really feel like it's a different world. And I've always been kind of just satisfied to do what I do in Maryland. And we do some local government stuff. I mean, for our clients, if there's a banking bill in Prince George's County or Queen Anne's County or Baltimore City, you know, we're going to cover that or Montgomery County or Prince George's. But the thought of going to D.C., I had nice personal relationships with some members. I mean, I was very close with Elijah Cummings. I was very close with Al Wynn, and other people that went down there, you know, over the years. I got to know Jamie Raskin really well when he was in the Senate, and I probably left a couple people out, but,
those are some good names.
That, you know, attempted to go beyond what I do in Maryland at the state and local level. So that's where my focus has always been.
You think you always feel a little bit lucky doing this job from the eyes of a young man that was trying to build a small boutique practice in Western Maryland outside of law school. And then, you know, now you're like, if I had more time to deal with Jamie Raskin, and, you know, so you've come a long way. I'd love to hear your thoughts of that person sort of looking at you now and what that Bob Etten would be saying about what he's seeing today with this Bob Etten.
Well, you know, I never imagined in my wildest dreams I would end up doing this for a living, believe me. And I just, back in 1983, I was with a small, like 8-lawyer law firm, and we did work for one of the automobile manufacturer financing arms. You know, there's Ford Motor Credit, there's GMAC. We had one of them, and I was just a young attorney and handled their case, you know, the litigation for them, basically mostly trying to collect, you know, trying to regain possession of cars for them when there was a default, or going to, you know, the district court on a judgment, so, you know, for a lawsuit after you most of the time it sold the vehicle. And all of a sudden, the Baltimore City State's Attorney's Office, they decided that they were going to seek forfeiture of every car where there was any drugs at all. And in the past, what they would do is they would check with the MVA, and if there was a lien on the car, they turn the car over to the lien holder and let the lien holder deal with it. And now all of a sudden, our client had all these cars sitting in the impound lot on Pulaski Highway in Baltimore, and they couldn't get them there. The law had no language in it whatsoever to deal with what a lien holder's rights were. And I was litigating these cases, and I was told to go down to Annapolis and get the law changed. I always tell people I didn't even know how to get to Annapolis. I didn't know the difference between, second reader and the weekly reader. And I was very fortunate that I got this bill passed for them. So I had one client, one bill. And then the next year, I had one client and two bills. And then the next year, the big break for me was picking up the Maryland Bankers Association as a client. They had a new executive president, and he came to town. You remember, maybe remember John Bowers. And I made him aware of this forfeiture issue because they wanted to expand it to real estate, which wasn't covered. And, you know, certainly that was going to have a huge impact on the banking industry if they were going to now start to be able to forfeit real estate where lenders had a mortgage on the real estate, you know, a lien on the real estate through a mortgage or deed of trust. And from there, he started giving me other things to do and all of it. And it kind of gave me instant credibility you know, here's this guy, you know, who nobody knew. I was never a staff person or anything for in the General Assembly, but, you know, he's representing the Maryland Bankers Association. And I went, I was never home. I went at night. I would go to fundraisers all over the state to be seen. And my practice just grew from there, you know. So, you know, to more clients, more bills, more clients, more bills. And once again, with the terrific backup that I've had for all these years, first at Weinberg and Green and then at Gordon Feinblatt. And I had a partner named Margie Corwin, who was the, probably the top banking lawyer in the state of Maryland, or one of them. And just a, you know, it's been really good.
You get to showcase in your role. You've done a nice job, I think, showcasing lawyers and others as subject matter experts. You know, part of being that resource to the Annapolis community is bringing the best and the brightest and people that are respectful of these public leaders' positions. You know, and I think you.
You got it. I mean, it's really helpful to me. And, you know, I'm not the only lawyer down there that's with a large firm that does lobbying. And I think it's you know, and there are lawyers, there are lobbying firms, small lobbying firms that you know, you know, everybody's got their strengths in Annapolis. Everybody's got their relationships. Everybody's got their strengths. You know, you do what you need to do to get the job done, whether you're with a small firm or with a large firm. I think, you know, the lobbying corps in Annapolis, there are, you know, a bunch of us that I think, you know, really represent their clients well.
You came from what I view as, you know, for better or for worse, and sometimes I think it's for worse, but the generation of lobbyists that you were sort of premier and ahead of this culture in some way, but right around while you're at the peak of your career, you have this incredibly competitive culture where all the top lobbyists are just really, I mean, viciously competitive. I always looked at that and was like, man, I don't have the thick enough skin to be at that level, you know, because there's the lobbying, and then there's like just constantly swatting things away from your reputation. You've come out not only unscathed, but as someone we talked about earlier, as the best lawyer best lawyers in America, saying that you're the best lawyer in the Baltimore region. I just love your comment on the competitive nature of lobbying as you got into it at its peak. And then, you know, has it reached new peaks, or would you say this next generation is a little more, as I see it, collaborative? It's all loaded question for you to deal with here. And I've got one more question for you after this, but I'll let you go, but I'm having such a fun time with you. So thank you for sticking with me.
Well, yeah. So I would say this, look, you're right. When I came down there, you know, Jim Doyle was the Dean of Maryland Lobbyists. And just to very quickly give you a Jim Doyle story, never forget, we were in, I think, what was the old Environmental Matters Committee hearing room. And there was some bill, I mean, the room was packed, and every lobbyist in Annapolis was signed up to testify. And they would go to the table and, you know, go one and one and whatever. And finally, they called Doyle. And I forget what client it was. And, you know, the legislators were getting, in those days in particular, you know, they didn't have computers at their desks like they do now. And, you know, some of them were reading the newspaper, you know, looking around, you know, talking to each other, because the hearing was just going on forever. And the room was, like I say, was packed. It was standing room only. And finally, Doyle gets up there and he goes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name's Jim Doyle. I'm an attorney from Baltimore. He said, and I know you all know that I've been doing this for a long time. And he said, and there are certain things I've learned over the years. He says, for instance, he says, I know and I've learned, and now I know that there are 16 lights in this ceiling. And he points, puts his finger up in the air and points to the ceiling. And every single person in that room was looking at the ceiling, counting the lights. They all stopped what they were doing. They stopped talking to each other, reading the newspaper. Everyone in the audience, all up there counting the lights. And he goes, and there's one other thing that I know, and that's that this is a bad bill. Thank you. And he sits down. So, I mean, he was, you know, he was the dean, and you had Franklin Goldstein and Jim Doyle, and
it went from it went from a little bit of a secret, like that this is a place where you, as a lawyer or as an advocate, you could really have an impact and a handsome career, you know. But I feel like after that point, you know, it really revved up as far as the number of firms and the amount of money coming into to state
health. No question. No question about it. But, you know, when I look at my colleagues, you know, I think you're right. It is more collaborative. I get, you know, we get retained by, you know, other lobbying firms will want to bring us on board. And sometimes I bring them on board. You know, if you've got a really, really, really tough issue that's really, really important to a client that's got resources and you're really up against it, we all have different relationships. And, you know, you'll bring on another lobbying firm to help you out. And I get
your relationship is with Relentless.
Yes, right, exactly. I mean, so, you know, I mean, generally speaking, just like you want to have good relationships with legislators, you also want to have good relationships with your colleagues. And, you know, some are better than others, but, you know, it's important to get along with people in life in general, but also I think in professionally, I don't care what business you're in. I mean, I try to adopt this attitude of what's the downside of being nice to people? You know, what is the downside of being nice to people? What's the downside of being nice to the woman who comes in with a big trash cart every morning to the legislator's offices and clears out the trash? You know, I'm on a first name basis with her. You know, what's the downside of being nice to staff? What's the downside of being nice to you know, the cashier at the supermarket? What's the downside? I've never understood, you know, what's wrong with being nice to people, no matter who they are.
People think it's time, right? Yeah. People think, you know, let's say they're well-intentioned. People think, oh, I would love to say hi to this, the person that's delivering janitorial services for the Department of General Services, but I'm late for this meeting with the chair, madam. And their head does that quicker than they probably realize. You know, you've been committed to giving a lot of people a lot of time.
Well, I just feel like it's, you know, and I do it when we're in session, when we're not in session. It's just part of my philosophy, I guess. And I think other people in Annapolis, you know, share that. And, but I just think it doesn't hurt. Why not be nice to people? And, you know, I think there are, you know, look, I'm, you know, I think Barry Ano and I are the two oldest lobbyists down there now, probably. And there's a lot of young, very good lobbyists out there. And, you know, I try to, you know, I hope they like me. I like them for the most part. And that's what we do. I mean, you know, it's I think it helps to make you successful. They have conflicts of interest and they refer business to me. I have a conflict of interest. I refer business to them. So
let me take you back. Just, I would love to get your thoughts on the context of this era. Of, you know, I just, sometimes I'm like, you know, when the Senate I came from, I thought that was a pretty quiet place. But in retrospect, you know, the state Senate, Senate of Maryland that I grew up in, by compare, seems very loud to me. And, you know, you made me think of this when I hearken back to Michael Powell and that Senate Finance Committee. I remember coming down the steps from EEA. We would finish pretty early, you know, because the delegations did all the hard work with the liquor bills and such. So we'd come down early,
you know, and you just had a day with Clarence Blount, who was just like the right. sublime, quiet. But then you'd come down the steps and it would be like Chairman Bromwell and hooting and hollering. Like, it was like a full on scene. And then you come down the steps, you look down to the right, and there's Chair Madam Hoffman, who was like the biggest thing in politics I ever ran into to this day, I think. And she was like 4'9 or 4'11, but she's still the biggest thing I've ever run into in politics. I bet you Martin O'Malley might even agree with that, you know, or Larry Hogan. I think it might, she would be barking at people and, you know, telling people the deal. And you could literally hear her and you could hear Chairman Bromwell at the same time, like in stereo. And then I would just kind of like run back up to EEA. And then I never really even knew sort of Walter Baker was, he was upstairs. And, you know, that was another place, even as a young lawyer, I never thought I belonged. I was smart enough to stay up there at JPR, but I'd love to hear your recollections of that era relative to today.
Well, it was interesting. So, Mike Miller was the chairman of JPR when I had my first bill. You know, the speakers that I've been through, you know, the first bill I had, which was this forfeiture bill, was in 1985. Ben Cardin was his speaker, and then it was Clay Mitchell, and then it was Casper Taylor, then Mike Bush. Now we got Adrian Jones on the Senate side. It was Harry Hughes. Harry Hughes was governor. Schaefer, I've been through Hughes, Schaefer, Glendening, Ehrlich, O'Malley, and Hogan. It was interesting. On the Senate side, was a lot different. It was, you know, Mickey Steinberg, Mike Miller, and in my tenure, and now Bill Ferguson. So, you know, it's everybody has different personalities. The chairs in those days, you know, you're right, Blount was very reserved, very gentlemanly, polite, calm. To everyone. He'd be in his office like at 8 o'clock at night, and in the old Senate office building, I could walk around the back and I could see the light on in his office. And I would walk up the stairs like at 7 or 8 o'clock at night, and there was nobody to keep me out. There was no secretary out there that would say, oh, he can't see you, you know? So his door would be slightly open, right? And the light would be on, and I'd knock on it. And he'd say, come in. And I'd walk in, and he'd shake his head and say, oh, my goodness, yes, what can I do for you? Yeah. I mean, so it was it was somewhat different. In those days, the offices were more accessible. I think, and, you know, Walter Baker was a great, great, great personal friend of mine. Our rooms were next to each other at the Governor Calvert House. We would go on vacation together.
Wow.
I don't know why. I mean, I just loved him, and he loved, you know, he really, really liked me and his wife, Jeannie. I knew his children, and Jeannie would always tell the story because our rooms were next to each other. But, you know, she was in the, they had a two, in fact, I have his old room at the Calvert House now. It's wow. A two room suite. And Jeannie would always tell the story that one morning she was in the bathroom. She came out and there I was sitting in bed with Walter in the morning. And, you know, look, when Bush was chairman of ECM, I'd be in there all the time. And Ronnie Gunz was chairman of Environmental Matters. You know, Joe Valerio was chairman of Judiciary. It's all kind of ancient history now, but I have there's a lot of funny stories. One time I was lobbying Joe Valerio for the bankers on an estates and trust bill. And Joe's daughter, I'm blanking on her first name now, was an estates and trust lawyer. I said, and I'm in his office. I said, Joe, if you don't believe me, call your daughter and ask her what she thinks about this bill. She goes, okay. He picks up the phone. Gets his daughter on the phone, says, I got Bob Enton sitting here. And what about this such and such bill that does such and such? And she's not, you know, he's nodding her head. Okay, okay, okay. All right, thanks. He hangs up. She goes, she's 1,000% in support of this bill. She thinks it's a great bill, but Bob, this bill's dead. So, I mean, I have all those stories. I got a million stories, believe me. But, you know, it was everybody's got their different personalities and everything. And I think and maybe it's just because I don't go out as much as I used to. When I was younger on going down there, but you know, in those days you would see a lot of people out in Franny O'Brien's at night. And, you know, that was the place to go. I mean, almost every night of the week, Franny O'Brien's can be packed with legislators and packed with lobbyists. And that was how it was in those days. Look, Tommy Bromwell was a huge character.
Right. Remains as such. I had an hour-long conversation with him last year, right before the pandemic. And it was like the greatest phone call in 5 years.
Yeah. He was a character. The things that he would come up with on the floor were just sometimes just hilarious, but right on the mark. You know, he was... He was something. So it was, you know, a lot of colorful characters, and there are colorful characters down there now for sure. But, you know, things evolve. And
well, we're going to see him on Zoom more and more, or the live show will go on. Any thoughts on that?
Well, if I had to guess going forward, I think that everything's going to be live, I hope, unless the pandemic continues to get worse and worse, and who knows, with this uptick we've got now. But then I also would think that with the technology now, the House and the Senate proceedings on the floor will be live. The committee hearings, I would think, would continue to be live. I don't know that they'll have people testifying virtually, but I think the public will certainly be able to watch everything virtually, voting sessions, subcommittees, the whole deal. I think it'll be a different world. Whereas before you there was limited viewing of things. The last year, the viewing of like voting sessions, the viewing of Senate proceedings, that was all kind of new. And I would imagine that will continue, but I would think they want to go back to live hearings and live testimony again. But who knows? I mean, we'll see what happens. I don't know how it'll be, but you know, we'll adjust just like we did last year. We'll adjust to it, and that's what we do. So
let me take advantage of my podcast host role here and. Just say that you and I both had a very similar experience in our lives as young fathers. We had daughters that got, as we say in my business, jammed up with some right, pretty serious right. health issues.
Right.
And I just want to always say that, you are always a inspiration for me to look at somebody that I said, we can get through this stuff. You know, Bob got through this stuff. It's hard, but look at that guy.
That's very, very nice of you to say that, Damien. So I'm in South Carolina. My daughter lives in Charleston. So I come to, and I have a 18-month-old grandson, Freddie. And so we come down here now four times a year. We stay at Kiowa, and my daughter and her husband come out and stay with us. You know, we're about 30 minutes from downtown Charleston out here. And my grandson is up... My daughter's little boy, Freddie, is upstairs taking his morning nap. And my daughter's sitting at the dining room table. I'm out on the porch. She's sitting at the dining room table work.
Freddie's got a survivor, 12-year-old babysitter. If he needs one, and then when he grows up, I bet they'll both be mean golfers if they got any of our blood in them.
Well, they may be mean. I don't know about that.
All right, you heard him here. D. Robert Anton, named Best Lawyer of America. D. Robert.
And I'm just going to say it again. Named by Best Lawyers of America as the 2022 Government Relations Lawyer of the Year in Baltimore. Pretty incredible. Congratulations again, Bob. Thanks so much for joining us on the lobby.
Thank you, Damon. I look forward to seeing you when I go out to Aspen.
That's right. I'll show you the elephant dance out here.
Okay, sounds great.
All right. Thanks. Take care.
See ya.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.